All right, welcome back. Our third speaker this afternoon comes to us from Harvard University. Roberto Mangabeira Unger has already been introduced by the previous speakers, but now we have the pleasure of having him speak to us on a universe in which everything changes sooner or later. Please help me welcome Professor Unger.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
It is what it is till it ain't anymore. So goes the lyric of a country western song. This lyric describes the two most important features of natural reality. The first is that it is drenched in time, and everything is perpetually becoming and ceasing to be. The second is that the world is factitious. Its most important attribute, aside from its temporality, is that it is what it is, rather than something else. The conception of a universe in which everything changes sooner or later can find inspiration in the most important discovery of 20th century cosmology: the discovery that the universe has a history. The simple statement that the universe is about 13.7 billion years old has no meaning outside a historical account. Nevertheless, the dominant ideas in 20th century science fail to provide a secure basis for historical thinking about nature. In those dominant ideas, the historical remains subordinate to the structural. What is required to make sense of the most important discovery of 20th century cosmology is to reverse this order in such a way that the structural becomes subordinate to the historical. That is the science that we do not yet possess, at least not in physics and in cosmology. And it is therefore the theme of this intervention of mine. I proceed by making five sets of remarks. The first set of remarks goes to the task of transforming cosmology into a historical science. The second set of remarks addresses an implication of the project of a historical science, which is the mutability of the laws of nature. The third set of remarks speaks to the nature of time. The fourth set of remarks relates these ideas to the established theories in fundamental physics. And the fifth set of remarks makes explicit the discourse in which I advance these propositions, which is the discourse of natural philosophy rather than the philosophy of science. So first, the project of turning cosmology into a historical science. when 20th century cosmology made its discoveries about the historical character of the universe, discoveries that are now encoded in the standard cosmological model, it found already established on the scene theories that were fundamentally anti-historical. Relativity, both special and general, and quantum mechanics. And the relationship between the dominant anti-historical theories and the disturbing historical discovery has never since been fully elucidated. Now, what I want to say by way of giving some content to the task of making cosmology a historical science goes by way of speaking first to the motivations of such a project within science, and second to the fundamental obstacles that must be overcome if the project is to advance. I enumerate three such motivations. The first motivation is to be able to begin answering the question, where do the laws of nature, or more generally, the laws, symmetries, and supposed constants come from? And where do the initial conditions of the universe come from? The historical way of thinking, in which a before always influences an after, extends the range of causal inquiry within which natural science can work. For this extension to take place with adequate vigor, it becomes necessary to repudiate the inference of an initial infinite singularity from the field equations of general relativity. And to understand this inference, not as the description of any physical state of affairs, but rather as the manifestation of the breakdown of a theory when carried beyond its proper domain of application. The second motivation of this historicizing turn is to make sense of the relation between change in the constitution of nature and change in the regularities of nature. What I mean by the constitution of nature are the elementary constituents of nature and the way that they are organized. Now, the empirical findings of cosmology give us increasing reason to believe that everything in the constitution of nature, as we observe it in the cooled-down universe, was once different from what it subsequently became, and may become different again. It is then not self-evident, and perhaps not even reasonable, that one should imagine at the center of science the combination of the idea of a changing structure with unchanging regularities, the laws, symmetries, and supposed constants. It would be necessary to analogize the situation to the situation of the physics of phase transitions, which, however, describes merely local and recurrent events. It would be much more reasonable and promising to suppose that the change in the structure or the constitution of nature is accompanied by a change in the regularities. And that science can proceed in such a way, we know for a fact, because that is the way in which it does proceed in the life and earth sciences and in natural history. The third motivation of the historicizing turn is to offer a strong alternative to a combination of ideas that has become calamitously ascendant in the aftermath of the Einsteinian period. String theory, the speculative concept of the multiverse, the theories of inflation and of eternal inflation, and the undisciplined teleology of anthropic reasoning. This ominous turn in the history of science threatens to loosen the discipline of the empirical and experimental methods on which the tradition inaugurated by Galileo and by Newton was founded. The third motivation, therefore, of the historical turn is to show another way. Now, I suggested that I would offer also, as a proposal for description of the content of the task, a view of the obstacles. And there are two such major obstacles, which I describe as cosmological fallacies. Smolin has spoken to the first of these fallacies, the one that we label the Newtonian paradox. It supposes that each piece of nature can be investigated by distinguishing between stipulated initial conditions and timeless laws that apply within a particular domain defined or bounded by these initial conditions. And then the supposition is that what is an unexplained initial condition in one instance of this explanatory practice may become an explained phenomenon in another instance, as if science would proceed with a searchlight illuminating piece by piece each part of nature. The trouble is that this distinction between initial conditions and laws applying within the bounded domain breaks down and becomes illegitimate when its subject is the universe as a whole. The second cosmological fallacy is the disposition to identify as the eternal character of nature the features that nature displays in the cool-down universe. A discriminate structure, a stable repertory of natural kinds, and unchanging laws governing this discriminate structure. But increasingly, we have reason to suppose that nature was not always like this. Not in the earliest moments of the universe. Not in certain extreme situations that it may display later in its history, and not perhaps at other moments in its future. The second cosmological fallacy is a fallacy of universal anachronism. And it mistakes the manifestation of nature in the cool-down universe for the character of nature as such. There may have been another nature with no such discriminant structure, with no clear distinction between the regularities and the phenomena that they govern, and even nature in a circumstance in which all events are singular events and causation fails to display its law-like repetitious character so prominently displayed in the cool-down universe. What is at stake in the project of a historical cosmology is the creation, the revolutionary creation of a science untainted by these two cosmological fallacies. And that science we do not yet possess. Now I come to my second set of remarks. My second set of remarks concerns the mutability of the laws of nature. And I begin this second set of remarks by observing that when 20th century physics and cosmology achieved their remarkable transformation of denying a distinction between an absolute unchanging background of space and time and the world of the phenomena, they nevertheless reaffirmed with a vengeance another distinction. The distinction between natural reality as they represented it and an immutable framework of natural laws beyond time. In fact, the science that results from these 20th century achievements accords two great exemptions from the reach of change. On the one hand, to the basic structure of nature, and on the other hand, to the regularities that govern the natural phenomena. These regularities are moving but unmoved bystanders rather than protagonists in universal history. And placed beyond the reach of any form of reciprocated action. In the history of science and of thinking about science, many have agreed with Poincaré that the practice of natural science cannot dispense with the idea of immutable laws. And only a very few, such as Dirac and Feynman, ever suggested that the laws of nature might change. In the project of a historical science and of cosmology as a historical science, no such double exemption from the reach of time can be allowed, either to the basic structures or to the regularities of nature. To develop our scientific thinking along these lines, the threshold task is to overcome our confusion about causation. Modern thinking about causation, thinking in modern philosophy since Hume and Kant, has been dominated by two ideas. The first idea is that causation is not a feature of nature, but a presupposition of the human mind. And the second idea is that all of our causal explanations must be warranted by underlying laws or symmetries or constants. The laws are the warrants of our causal judgments according to this point of view. Now I simply affirm, without further elucidation at this point, that this way of thinking about causation stands as an unacceptable impediment to the development of our historical thinking about nature. And we should rather embrace a view of causation founded on the rejection of those two main foundations of the modern approach to causality. Causation is better understood first as a primitive feature of nature, intimately related to the inclusive reality of time. And the relation between causation and laws is, in a sense, the opposite of what it is represented to be by this dominant approach in modern philosophy. Causal connections may or may not display a repetitious and law-like character. They may not have displayed this character in the extreme states of nature or the formative moments of the universe. The laws of nature are a mode of causality rather than the foundation of causal connections or the warrant of causal explanations. If we advance along these lines, we come to the idea, central to the project of a historical science, that nothing is outside the reach of time. Not even the most elementary structure of nature or its regularities, that everything may change and will change sooner or later. And when we attempt to develop science along these lines, we then confront two great difficulties. Our way of addressing these difficulties then defines the future of such a science. The first difficulty is how we are to reconcile the mutability of the laws of nature with their stability in the cool-down universe that we observe. Stability is not immutability. And the beginning of such a reconciliation lies in the idea to which I earlier alluded, of the fundamental transformations that nature may undergo. Nature being at some moments or situations different from what it appears to be in the cool-down universe. The second difficulty is the difficulty that Smolin described as the conundrum of the meta-laws. We imagine that both the structure and the laws change. If we then suppose that the change of the laws is itself law-governed, we have an infinite regress, and once again the problem of the exemption from time. And if, on the contrary, we suppose that the change of the laws is not law-governed, it appears to be arbitrary and unexplained. This is the conundrum of the meta-laws. And the beginning of a solution to the conundrum of the meta-laws lies in appreciating the primitive character and variability of causation. We may then find inspiration in the practices of the life and earth sciences or of natural history, and in three ideas or moves that are central to those sciences. The first is the pervasiveness of path dependency. The second is the idea of the mutability of types and of natural kinds. And the third is the notion of the coevolution of the laws and of the phenomena. Under the ideology that sees the physics of Newton and Galileo as the gold standard, biology as weak physics, and social and historical study as weak biology, it is inconceivable that physics and cosmology might find inspiration in their weak cousins. But not only might they, but they should. And this observation leads me then to another reflection on the evolution of social and historical study of social theory. The revolutionary insight of classical social theory, prominently displayed in the career of Marxism, was the notion of structure, of structural transformation, as the heart of the understanding of human phenomena. And the true task of transformative politics is then to change the structure. Now, Marx and other classical social theorists supposed that it is impossible to advance structural explanation and develop structural vision without appealing to the notion of historical laws of transformation governing the succession of the structures, in Marx's vocabulary, the modes of production. And no one, or almost no one, can believe any longer in that idea. William James said, people believe in everything they can. There is an idea in which they no longer find themselves able to believe. And it was feared that the loss of faith in such laws of historical change would then result in a disastrous causal agnosticism. We would be unable to begin to understand the transformation of the structures if we could not appeal to these laws governing the succession of structures. And yet social and historical study has gone on and recovered from this loss of faith, and its whole task can be summarized in the effort to rescue the structural vision from the incubus of the necessitarian illusions of classical social theory. I say all of this to suggest that the problems of a historical cosmology have a counterpart in the other branches of thought. Now I make my third set of remarks about time. Central to these ideas is the notion of the inclusive reality of time. But what is time under this view? Time is the fundamental aspect of reality of nature, by virtue of which everything is susceptible to change, to differential change. Everything changes, including change itself. And thus one might say formulaically that, among other things, time is the transformation of transformation. Anaximander, at the very beginning of the tradition of Western science, says, everything arises from everything else and vanishes into everything else, according to necessity under the dominion of time. What Anaximander describes is the true subject matter of science, the process of ceasing to be and of becoming. If anything is real, that is real. Now, this view of time and of the subject of science cannot be adequately captured by the stock positions of the school philosophy about time today. It cannot be accommodated by presentism, which says that only what is real in the present moment is real. What is real, what is above all real, is this process. And it cannot be accommodated by eternalism, which denies the reality of the distinctions among past, present, and future, by its appeal to a stringent, time-destroying determinism. Where then is the enemy of time? The enemy of time is not in the paper tigers, the fanciful philosophical objections. There was once a serious philosophical discourse about time. In the dominant philosophies of ancient India and in the West, in philosophers such as Plato, Spinoza, and Schopenhauer, in whose systems the denial of the permanence of the structure of the world was associated with the denial of the reality of time. Now, the truth seems to be just the opposite of the thesis advanced in those philosophies. The truth is that everything is insubstantial and impermanent precisely because time is real. And it is that view that we do not have established in either our philosophy or our science. Where is the threat to that view? The threat to that view is not in these fanciful philosophical objections. The threat to that view comes from one place, mathematics. The indispensable tool of natural science, but at the same time, the greatest threat to its understanding of nature. Mathematics is a visionary exploration of a simulacrum of the world from which phenomenal distinction and time have been sucked out. An essential feature of mathematics is its atemporality, even when it is used to describe temporal processes. The relation between one mathematical proposition and another is outside of time. And we are therefore tempted to attribute to nature this characteristic of mathematics, treating mathematics as both the oracle of nature and the prophet of science, neither of which it deserves to be. Its power arises from its selectivity, and its effectiveness in natural science is reasonable because it is only relative. Mathematics is a Trojan horse established within the human mind against recognition of the reality of time. And in exchange for its gifts to science, it also offers natural science the poison chalice of the idea of timeless laws of nature. Now I make my fourth set of remarks about the relation of these ideas to the established conceptions in natural science. I will confine myself to a single series of observations about the point of greatest tension, which is with the predominant interpretations of general relativity. For these ideas to advance and to be accepted within physics and cosmology, at least three adjustments of the relativistic ideas would be required. The first adjustment is that the relativity of simultaneity not be held to be a bar against the recognition of a cosmic preferred time. The inclusive reality of time can only be fully established if we affirm that, in principle, everything that has ever happened in the history of nature can, in principle, be placed on a single continuous time chart. And we must then say that the universe has certain contingent features that make such a cosmic preferred time possible, such that there is a frame of reference with respect to which all the galaxies recede at the same speed, or with regard to which the cosmic microwave radiation background strikes at the same temperature. The second adjustment is the rejection of the idea of the infinite initial singularity as an arbitrary bar to the broadening of causal inquiry, and as a confusion of a limitation of the theory with a description of physical nature. Behind the idea of the infinite initial singularity stands the idea of the infinite, which has no presence in physical nature. And behind the idea of the infinite stand the dangerous seductions of mathematics. The third adjustment of the relativistic conceptions is the most important. And that is the attempt to distinguish the empirically validated core of the theory from the superimposed metaphysical patina of the idea of the space-time continuum, which serves the larger project of the spatialization of time, that is to say, the dismissal or degradation of time into an incident to the shaping of space according to the disposition of matter and motion in the universe. These are no small adjustments, and their weight reveals the significance of what is at stake in the prosecution of the campaign to revise cosmology as a historical science. I now make my fifth and last set of remarks. In what voice am I speaking? Certainly not in the voice of science, although what I have said is in some sense an intervention in the controversies of science, but also not in the voice of the philosophy of science as it is now understood in practice. I am speaking in the voice of the genre that used to be called natural philosophy. Whereas the proximate subject matter of the philosophy of science is science, the proximate subject matter of natural philosophy is nature. Natural philosophy, unlike the philosophy of science, shares its subject matter with science. And unlike the philosophy of science, it has frankly revisionist intentions. It is not simply an interpretation of scientific theories which it takes as given and to which it genuflects. In physics, natural philosophy existed up to the period of Poincaré and Mach. It has a presence in biology, but almost no presence today in physics in its own right. But it has an afterlife, a secret afterlife, in the form of the popularizing works written by scientists, who, finding no genre in which they can address the problems of natural philosophy, do it under the cover, under disguise, in the form of popularizing works. How is it that natural science can aspire to make revisionist claims if it lacks the empirical and experimental equipment of natural science? It can do so as the ally of science by a combination of moves or methods. And I now simply enumerate three such moves or methods, each of which has been illustrated in my previous remarks. The first method is the method of jumbling up, by which I mean the subversion of the fixed associations between methods and domains. So you say, the method of physics is such and such, the method of the life and earth sciences is such and such. And there seems to be a natural affinity between the method and its subject matter, but there is not. And the history of thought is in large part the history of the destruction of these supposedly necessary connections between method and subject. The second move or method of natural philosophy is the method of jumping over directly from the speculative to the empirical intuition. Without proceeding through a fixed intermediate structure of theoretical ideas, but rather only suggesting and suggesting to science alternative theoretical agendas. And the third move or method is the most important. It is the method of divorce. All major scientific systems, like those of Aristotle, Newton, and Einstein, are founded on a marriage between a set of interpreted empirical discoveries and a supra-empirical ontology. In relativity, it is the ontology of the space-time continuum. From time to time, for science to progress, it is necessary to dissolve this marriage and to sue for divorce. And that is exactly what I proposed in my previous argument. Now I have concluded my intervention, vindicating and elucidating the idea of cosmology as a historical science. My claim is that such a science does not yet exist, but that all of the elements necessary to develop it are already at hand. It may seem strange that a campaign in cosmology, in manifest sympathy with tendencies prevailing in almost every department of thought other than physics, should seem to require a revolution in the established cosmological ideas. Yet nothing less than a revolution would be enough.
Raise a hundred questions, but I will restrict myself to three. One, you speak about the empirical and experimental method. Yet, if we've learned anything, and here I refer to the work of Bachelard, one cannot separate experiment from theory. Bachelard speaks of experimental apparatus as materialized theorems. We do not observe a photon, we do not observe an electron, we have an observation with a piece of apparatus which is based on a whole theoretical structure, so one cannot separate the theoretical structure from the empirical observation. That's my first point. Secondly, we talk about cosmology, the formative moments of the universe. Is the Big Bang cosmology falsifiable? If it's not, then what is it? If it is falsifiable, how can you construct your whole approach on the basis of the Big Bang cosmology? It seems to me one has to recognize the very modest, that cosmology, speaking of the whole universe, should be approached very modestly. First of all, is the whole universe an open system or a closed system? If it's an open system, then, and for example, as in the Bondi-Hoyle models, then one can't make many of the assertions that you have made. And the Bondi-Hoyle model was not rejected because of incoherence, but because it was a generating research program. That's my second point. Third, I think you're simply wrong about Marx. As long ago as 1951, I gave a course to Labor Youth League on Marxism, and I quoted Marx's letter of 1877 to Vera Zasulis. Let me just give you a few quotes from that. The chapter on primitive accumulation claims no more than to trace the path by which in Western Europe the capitalist economic order emerged from the womb of the feudal economic order. He says it is Russian critic. He absolutely insists on transforming a historical sketch of the genesis of capitalism in Western Europe in capital into a historical philosophical theory of the general course fatally opposed on all peoples, whatever the style of circumstances in which they find themselves placed, in order to rot ultimately at the economic formation which includes the greatest expansion of productive force of labor, etc., etc. But I beg his pardon. This is to me both too much honor and too much discredit. French tour d'honneur, tour d'honneur. And then he goes on to discuss the case of the difference between the primitive Rome, ancient Roman situation when the certain situation arose, which seemed analogous to dispossession of the proletariat in Western Europe. And he points out the events of striking similarity taking place in different historical contexts led to totally disparate results. By studying each of these elements separately and then comparing them, one may easily discover the key to this phenomenon. But success will never come with the master key of a general historical philosophical theory whose supreme virtue consists in being super historical. These are monsters.
So going back, I would rather not enter into the debate about Marxist theory here because it's a subject of central interest to me, but it's enough to discuss the universe for an afternoon. But I simply say that I mentioned it in a particular context, which is relevant to our discussion. And the context is that what we discover in the history of social theory is that it should not be necessary to choose between a style of social science, the dominant style of positive social science, as now practiced in the American Academy, that is bereft of any structural vision, and a structural vision that acquires structural vision only at the cost of proposing that history is governed by a series of laws which drive forward the succession of the structures. That's an unacceptable choice, and that it is unacceptable has been demonstrated, to my mind, by the recent history of social theory.
And it's not Marx's choice.
Yeah, now we go back to the to your earlier questions, in which you may disagree with me, but I don't disagree with you. I find no point of disagreement in this respect. I believe that the standard cosmological model is falsifiable in the sense that any ambitious scientific conception is, not directly, but through its inferences, through its consequences, and is part of a way of thinking that then opens a field for causal inquiry. What replaces the idea of a plurality of universes is the idea of succession. And we can describe succession either as a succession of universes or as a succession of states of the one real universe in time. And then we come to your first observation.
Wait a minute. You've made the fact that the universe has a history.
Has a history.
If one doesn't accept the Big Bang point of view, or some variant of it, if one accepts a steady-state universe, then the universe doesn't have a history.
No, you're right. You're right, but that's an empirical claim. It's not simply one
speculative conception. One can't found one's whole philosophy on an empirical claim, it seems to me.
Well, I don't understand. I'm speaking here about science. I'm claiming that the most important discovery of 20th century cosmology, the historical character of the universe, beginning in these early explosive events, has to be understood within the context of a historical science.
Yeah, this whole approach is dark matter, dark energy, which is not solved. A problematic situation. How can you found your philosophy?
Yes, but the problem. Yeah,
John,
but
there
the
are other questions. I'm going to have to. Sorry.
Yes.
Go ahead.
All right. Two things that caught my attention. You spoke about that change. Time represents the change of change.
Yes.
Now, the only example, one very clear example that I know, as I'm a particle cosmologist, I work with you, right? The interface of those two things. So there are two examples where I feel there's kind of opportunity to further this. You said that also we don't yet have this new science.
Yes.
But you know, one example that I find interesting, where change is really important, like say at a quote unquote fundamental level, is in beta decay, inverse beta decay. The weak interaction is right. All of the nuclear decay occurs primarily because of pattern violation, and then through the interaction of this, the weak interaction, we get beta decay. So my question here is, here's an example where you have the breaking of a symmetry.
Yes.
Okay. As opposed to all the other symmetries of the other interactions that aren't broken in terms of left-right
yes.
symmetry. So my question here is that we see that interaction, okay, we have like the notion of an interaction governing change in this case. So the change is actually occurring from the perspective of an interaction. So how do we go beyond that? Let's say if we apply this, we say that it's not due to this, what we mean by change now in your, from coming from your perspective, is not due to interaction, then what would it be?
Would be if it's not due to interaction. So the idea is the regular, both the structure and the regularities change. So take a homely example again from biology. So the laws governing sexual selection or the Mendelian mechanisms arise together with the phenomena that they describe. Now, we can affirm that those laws are simply an inference from more fundamental laws of physics, or we can imagine that they were somehow waiting on the, in the background for their cue to come onto the stage of actuality. But these are just metaphysical conceptions. They have no operational significance. From the standpoint of the real science, the phenomena and the regularities develop together. And that's how we think. And we don't think that that's somehow a contradiction. But in this dominant tradition of physics, it does appear to be a contradiction, because the model of explanatory practice is so radically different. So what I'm saying is, signaling that this other way of thinking comes with an agenda of problems. And I describe what I believe to be the two most salient problems: reconciling the stability of the laws with their mutability, their stability in the cooldown universe, and dealing with what we label the conundrum of the meta laws. And we then begin to develop a conception of the imaginative space in which we are to look for solutions to those problems. That's another agenda. That's a whole different agenda of thinking. And I don't understand it as being at its heart an agenda of academic philosophy, of the philosophy of science. It's a scientific agenda. It's about the creation of a different kind of scientific practice.
Let's thank Professor Unger once again.